From Washington, D.C., you are listening to Rule of Law Albania with Albi Cela.
Going. Hello, everyone. My name is Pedro Bizzano. I'm here by invitation from your regular host, Albi Cela. This is episode number 14 of Rule of Law in Albania. And here I give you your regular host and my interviewee today, Albi Cela.
Pedro, thank you for having me.
Now, Albi, thanks for inviting me to your wonderful podcast and flipping the script. I think your listeners or our listeners want to know about who you are a little bit. So who are you? Why are you doing this podcast? What are your interests?
Pedro, so it's almost like 1 year now that I moved to the US to follow this program at Arizona State University, a program that is done in cooperation with the McCain Institute, the International Rule of Law and Security program, actually. So I have a background in law. From Albania, I graduated in law, Bachelor of Laws, and also Master of Science. And since the beginning, since I started studying law, I had a keen interest, especially in human rights, rule of law, and democracy. And that was the main reason, actually, that I applied at the International Rule of Law and Security program. And I was delighted when I got admitted to the program. The idea for this podcast, actually, it's funny because we all got locked up this year because of the COVID pandemic, and while staying at home all day, didn't know what to do. So I started listening to this podcast, shortwave, I think. And I was like, why not? I mean, I have the time. Why not start a podcast of my own? And I thought, like, podcasts in Albania are not so famous, are not so popular. People don't usually use them. And right now, I think I'm the only one, along with a friend of mine, a journalist in Albania, who recently opened a podcast. We're the only ones that have podcasts in Albania.
Wow.
Yeah. So yeah, I thought, why not? Like, it's a new form of freedom of speech, freedom of thought, freedom of expression. So I was like, why not? Let's try this.
So could you say, or would you allow me to say that you're the prime mover? You're the first podcast in modern Albania?
I could say yes.
Okay, well, fantastic. It's more of an honor than to be here. Now and also before, I've really enjoyed listening to most of your casts. I think I've listened to 6 or 7 of them, and I've really enjoyed our conversations and all the work that you do. I'm grateful to be here, and I wanted to talk a little bit more about your resume, if you don't mind, because I think it talks a little bit about our topic today, which is freedom of association, or what we'll end up calling public gathering. So would you like me to walk you through what I feel are your associations throughout your life as it relates to Albania? Or would you like to start us off telling us about whom you've associated with and why you've associated with them?
I guess we can go with the first approach. I mean, you can lead me.
Okay, so I mean, you've done a lot of things. I mean, you sell yourself short, as we usually do, and that's okay. Like, we usually allow other people to tell us or to compliment us, because otherwise it's too weird. But I see here that you were, for example, let's see. I mean, everything is interesting, but one of the things that stuck out to me was you were the European Union Institutions Project Coordinator and Trainer for the European Movement in Albania. What is that, and what did you do?
So back in 2017, when I was my first year of Master of Science degree in International Law, we were required to do these externships. So I got admitted at European Movement in Albania, which is a branch of European Movement Europe. And there I got in touch with these amazing people that work with civil society, especially on European integration. And that year, I mean, for a couple of years, they had been doing this simulation of the European Parliament. I guess you have heard of these MUs, like Model European Unions, around Europe, but also around the world. Like, I was surprised they were held also in Japan. I didn't know it. And that's how I got in touch with that. Like, the first year that I was an extern there, I was just helping them like with the logistics and stuff. And later that year, I got admitted at the Model European Union in Strasbourg, which is the greatest MEU in Europe, actually. And it is held in the headquarters of the European Parliament in Strasbourg. I was selected as a member of the parliament back then, and also the general secretary of the European People's Party. What they did is that they required us an application to write a short paper of our position. And what they did is they read your paper, they could see what your political affiliations were or your what ideologies you supported, and then they would put you in the opposite.
Oh, wow. That's
so
super
interesting. I was more of central leftist, I guess, in that paper of mine. So they put me in the center right, like at the EPP, at the European People's Party.
Wow.
And then when I came back, they wanted me to help them. Like, so we upgraded that local simulation that we were doing in Tirana. So that I did it for 3 years. So for 3 years, I helped them starting from 2017, 18, and 19. And it got bigger and bigger every year. I mean, it was an amazing experience. I had to work with around 60 students every year. We received at least 200 applications every year, so we had to go through them, select the members of the European Parliament, we had to select the commissioners, we had to select the ministers that would represent the countries, because we added also, we did not only the European Parliament, but also the Commission and the Council of Europe, actually. So it was a really beautiful process. And I'm really sad, like, even if I was in Albania this year, we couldn't have done it because of COVID. But yeah, let's hope that I can still contribute on organizations like that in the future.
For sure, you already are. And did the same principle apply? Like, all the students that were selected, they had to, like, flip to their ideological counterpart, for lack of a better word?
That's what we did. That, at least that's what we tried to do. Let's face it, we don't have a culture, you know, of these simulations, right. And students don't get it really much, and sometimes in their position papers they could tell that they were two partisans, like two I don't know how to say it, they were affiliated so much with one party, and when we tried them to put them on the other side, they wouldn't they wouldn't act normal.
Right, and how do you feel that practice, almost that virtue of trying to step into another shoes to understand them better, how do you feel that informs freedom of association?
Well, it definitely does. Like, I mean, you're not forced. Like, you're just you have to be in the, as you said it, you have to be in the shoes of someone else. You are associated with people who probably don't have the same ideological views as you. But again, they have to act as well. And then in the entire simulation in the parliament, we had to associate with other political groups, sometimes wishing we were on their shoes, where we belong to. But at the end of that week, I mean, we learned a lot in terms of associating with each other, like everything.
Yeah, well, one of the original Native American tribes of this continent, I think it's the Cherokee, but I'm not mistaken, always complete that saying. So that saying, as people know it, is to understand someone, you have to walk a mile in their shoes, right? That's what people say. And the Cherokee is like, no, that's not the complete saying or proverb. The actual complete saying is to be able to walk in someone else's shoes for a mile, you first have to take off your own shoes, right? That's the first thing you have to do. Because otherwise you're just walking in someone else's shoes with your own shoes and thinking what would they do as yourself, and that's not the point of the exercise. So it seems you did it well. And to move forward with the podcast, I just wanted to briefly mention another one, perhaps, of the most famous associations that you've freely associated yourself with, which is the Philip C. Jessop International Law Moot Court Competition. For the people who don't know what that is or why it's named after an American lawyer, I think, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about what that is, why it's so famous, and what you did and all your accomplishments there?
So I can say that's my longest association, actually, because I started, I'm involved with the Jessop for 6 years now. I did an episode, I think it's the second episode in Rule of Albania, which I spoke with one of my co-agents about the Philip Sijas Motocross competition, trying to spread it in Albania. But yeah, basically it started. So the university I graduated from is the first one to represent Albania actually in the international rounds. It was in 2014. We are still one of those new countries. Again, we don't have this culture of moot courts in Albania, especially international or public international law, and especially such a prestigious competition like the Philip Sijas. I guess you know it's the biggest moot court competition actually. So the JESAP started back in 1960. And it was named after one of the most prominent jurists, American jurists, Philip C. Jessup. He was also a judge at the International Court of Justice. And it actually started in Harvard with only two teams competing. There were two groups from Harvard University. And then it expanded year by year. And I think last year was the biggest Jessup like competition. It had more than 130 teams from all over the world who did the international rounds. Because usually it's around 800 teams from all over the world that try to get into the international rounds. I started doing the JESAP, as I said, back in 2015, initially as a backup agent, just assisting in researching. I was still in the first year of law studies back then. And then in the second year, third year, and fourth year, I was a team leader. So I did the JESAP 4 years as a competitor, as a speaker, as a researcher, basically. It was an amazing experience, like meeting all these people from all around the world, from different jurisdictions. Again, everything was so new to us because we come here, we are pleading in front of the International Court of Justice. We have to make up these arguments from this fictitious case regarding a dispute from these two fictitious countries. And as you know, back in Albania, we have a civil law system and we are taught differently. And the first thing when I came here in America, like American judges, all they wanted was common sense.
Right.
And they didn't teach that to us back in Albania. I mean, that's one of the things that I learned here, that just like common sense is the first thing that you can use in a moot court, especially when it comes to common law tradition.
So
again, it was an amazing experience.
Yeah, no, common sense, like Thomas Paine. Yeah, I think he has a book called Common Sense, but it's also the common sense of freedom of association. So we're here today to talk a little bit about freedom of association in Albania, but I wanted us to start, if you don't mind, with trying to define what freedom of association is and why it's important. So I'm here reading from Wikipedia, and it says, freedom of association encompasses both an individual's right to join or leave groups voluntarily, the right of the group to take collective action to pursue the interests of its members, and the right of an association to accept or decline membership based on certain criteria. Would you agree with that definition?
Yeah, that's like basically that's the definition that also the United Nations give to freedom of association, which is also goes along with the freedom of assembly. They're both freedoms that go along with each other. They're protected by international instruments, including the National Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. If I'm not mistaken, Article 21 and 22.
Correct.
Freedom of assembly and also freedom of associations. And to be honest, for me, as an advocate actually of human rights, and you yourself, I guess, I think freedom of association and assembly are the cornerstone of a democratic society. I mean, if the people are not given the opportunity to express their thoughts, their opinions, to gather with each other, to assemble, democracy will never flourish in those countries. And you can tell from these dictatorships or former communist countries, that's what the communist regimes did. Like they oppressed every sort of movement, every sort of gathering, because they feared that by gathering people will start thinking, will start talking with each other, and they eventually would want to topple down the regime. And actually that's how all the regimes fell around the world, including Albania, by people associating and by people gathering, assembling with each other.
Yeah, three things that I want to try to draw out from everything that you just said, which was correct and fascinating. The first one, and you don't have to answer it now, is what's the difference between freedom of association and freedom of assembly? The second one is, as you mentioned correctly, or as you alluded to, I mean, you didn't allude, but that's what I thought of the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution,
doesn't have anything about freedom of association or assembly, right? What it says is Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, but then it says, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. So in the US, at least Wikipedia says that the text of the First Amendment does not make a specific mention to a right of association, just to a right to peaceably assemble. But then nevertheless, according to Wikipedia, sorry to rely on one source, but allegedly Wikipedia in some ways is better than the Britannica Encyclopedia, at least to one study. It says that never court held in NAACP versus Alabama that freedom of association is an essential part of freedom of speech because, and this is what you said exactly, in many cases, people can engage in effective speech only when they join with others. So those were the two and three and the third thing that I wanted to draw out. First, the difference between assembly and association. The second one was the U.S. Constitution that doesn't mention right to association, but is nevertheless included. And the third, which was what you were referring to, that regimes of any sort are always or almost always toppled by people associating with each other, whether for good or evil ends, right? The people who became dictators in the first place were also exercising their freedom of association to associate themselves with quote-unquote people who didn't want, or evil people, quote-unquote.
I mean, yeah, with regard to the first one, actually the difference is really simple. Like, the freedom of assembly refers to the right of people to meet,
okay,
to gather with each other. In various ways, such as gatherings, protests, like riots. Even a riot is a form of assembly. And well, the freedom of association is the right that protects these activities, these compositions of such meetings of these people. So it's the act of gathering. Like when people gather, they are using both these rights. So they are assembling, they are protesting, but also they are associating with each other. Like association is, let's say, the institution of assembling.
Okay.
So with regard to the second, could you please remind me, because there were three points and kind of lost it.
Yeah, sorry. Right. I make a list in my head and then it's hard to remember. No, the second one was about how in the United States Constitution, there's no specific mention.
Yeah, but still, it's not mentioned. As you said correctly, it's derived actually from fundamental privacy interests and the rights of speech, petition, and petition. That's where it derives from the American Constitution. But I guess what I've noticed from staying here in the U.S., freedom of assembly actually is quite, let's say, sacred. Like, there's no such restrictions such as in Europe, I've noticed.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen around DC that people just gather together, like they start gathering and just block the street, for example. Like a couple of months ago, I was going home and I noticed that a group of people just walking by the sidewalk, there were like 20 of them, and they sat in the middle of the road. They blocked an intersection, and actually the police did nothing else but they blocked all the roads with their cars and deviated the traffic.
I
was surprised, and I don't want to portray like everything is perfect here in America right now, because we know what's happening with the BLM protests and stuff. There's been quite a police brutality actually, and forceful dispersal of protests. But still, I mean, in normal times, let's say, freedom of assembly here in the U.S. is quite sacred. Freedom of assembly is a sort of speech, let's say. Like, it's one of the ways, it's a freedom of expression. It's one of the ways you express yourself. And we both know, like, how sacred is, like, the freedom of speech here in the U.S.
Yeah, I'm reading here that case, the NAACP versus Patterson from the U.S. Supreme Court in 1958, and that's exactly what it says. It says, this court has recognized the vital relationship between freedom to associate and privacy in one's association.
Yeah.
So I think you're exactly right about the privacy rights there. and also about the very interesting American, in some ways people call it exceptional, but at least it's different from other countries, in which freedom of speech, at least, and what it says about freedom of association is also a bit different, right? Because we've talked about hate speech in the past, but it would seem that you're trying to make an argument that in freedom of association, at least anecdotally from your experiences here, but also from what you understand about the law, which I think is correct, is also a bit different from other contexts.
Yeah, it's complete. I mean, it's different from the European context, actually, the way people perceive the right to freedom of assembly or freedom of speech here in the US. Actually, in Europe, it's quite more restrictive.
And why do you think it's more restrictive in Europe?
I think it has to do... I answer better, like, why it's not so restrictive in the US. Like, American citizens, I've noticed that they have this sense of, like, they know they are the sovereign of the country.
Mm-hmm.
They know that they are the upholders of the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
They know that the people who they elect, they have to serve them.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that they have revolted, like, throughout the American history, like, there have been many protests, revolts, and stuff. So the American government, I think they have understood that the American people know their rights. And you can't suppress them so easily. Well, in Europe, it has been really, like, you know how the European history, like,
yep.
French Revolution, the Glorious Revolution in Great Britain, 1688, we have the French Revolution, and all these other, like, eras around Europe. It has been really difficult, like, you had these monarchies, because the U.S. was never a monarchy, so they actually never... experienced, like, let's say, dictatorship, authoritarianism, monarchy. While in Europe, they experience everything from the worst to the best.
Yeah, but, there's a famous story about George Washington. I don't know if it's true that they asked him to be king of America, and he said, "Well, what's the point of a revolution? And you're gonna install another king." So he refused.
Exactly. I mean, that's one of the reasons. I'm thinking, because all these big protests throughout the history in Europe, they have been brutally, like, killed, like, because the kings, the monarchs, they feared the people. But recently, in the recent years, there have been some, like, you know, the European Court of Human Rights has been more liberal, setting other standards, and people, like, countries around Europe have, like, they have lowered the bar.
Mm-hmm.
Of requirements for people to enjoy their right to freedom of assembly, which we will talk about later, especially in the Albanian context. But yeah, I mean, that's the biggest difference. Like, the U.S. have never experienced monarchies. U.S. citizens always knew their rights. They knew that they were the upholders of the American democracy, while in Europe, it varied, like, from decade to decade, from century to century.
Yeah, I was trying to read, as you were speaking, the text of the Declaration of Independence to see if they said there that they wouldn't replace a king with another king, because that's what I remember, but I don't think they do. I only think they do, what they say is that, you know, we hold these truths to be self-evident, and that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed.
Yeah.
Which is what you were saying, right? You were saying
yeah.
that Americans feel that politicians are not there to serve themselves, they're there to serve the people, and we, the people, will try by all means to hold them accountable. And one of the most important things to be able to hold people accountable is the freedom to associate yourself
with exactly.
people. Okay, perfect. Moving on, I wanted, before we dive deep into the law, I wanted to mention this satirical article that we shared today and yesterday. And it's an article from that great... before it was the only satirical site. Now there's a competition, which I love, The Onion. Now we have the Babylon Bee. And of course, Andy Berkowitz in The New Yorker is also a great satirist. I don't know how you pronounce it. Maybe it's satirist. I don't know. But anyways, there's an article about Albania in The Onion. And it starts like this: "The land of the free. 10 ways you know you're living in the greatest country on earth." And the first one, the first slide, it's a slideshow. The first slide says, "You place your hand on your heart and sing with fervor. when you hear the stirring opening line of the national anthem. This is the Albanian national anthem. Around our flag we stand united with one wish and one goal.
It's completely true. Like I deeply associate with that line and with that gesture of putting our hand in our heart. We were taught since we were kids in the school, in the primary school I went to, since I was 6 years old, every day in the morning we would sing our national anthem, and we would put our, they taught us to put our hand on our heart. And yeah, I truly associate myself with that. It's a thing that I guess they taught to every children in schools back then. I think they still continue to do it nowadays.
And why do you think, two things, why do you think that's important? And two, why do you think this is in the Onion? Why do you think this is supposed to be funny?
To be honest, with regard to the funny side, I don't know why they find it funny. Because also, I, from what I've seen, also other countries do the same. Usually when they sing their anthem, at least from what I've seen in Europe, that's what most countries do, what most nations do.
Right.
With regard to the first point, I think what they were trying to build up, like to make us feel more, not nationalistic, of course, to be proud of our country, how proud it is to be Albanian, that we must stand united. If like from the first line of our anthem, like around the flag we stand united with one wish and one goal, like there was this sentiment that like we should be united if we want Albania to move forward, and the only wish and goal was to help Albania move forward.
Right.
That's what they're trying to do, but I think it hasn't worked well enough, because it is sad to say, I feel like we Albanians, we love our country only, we deeply love our country of course, but we love our country mainly in our Independence Day.
Right.
And when our soccer team plays.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing, because I was born in Colombia, and last time Colombia played, I think it was, maybe it was in the World Cup, or the last time I wore the t-shirt, and I actually bought a jersey for my girlfriend's cat. So my girlfriend had a jersey, I had a jersey, and my cat, her cat, had a jersey of Colombia. And I posted a picture, and I said, benign nationalism, question mark. And the question I was trying to ask there in a half funny satirical way is whether and to what extent what we call these days, for lack of a better word, nationalism, can be a force for good. And I guess that's the same thing you're saying.
Yeah.
But coming back to why it's supposed to be funny, I wanted to mention this. Because I think satire is one of the most powerful tools against autocrats or authority, right? You gotta be, what tyrants really fear the most is that you laugh at them, right?
When you mock them, yeah. Exactly.
And I think this light show is very well done, because it goes like deeper and deeper into making fun, right? The first one is like, okay, yeah, national anthem, everyone sings their national anthem, what's wrong with that? And then it goes, and number 10 says, no matter whom you voted for, you support your president, especially if it's President Bujar Nishani, kicking ass and transitioning the Albanian economy to a free market model since July 2012.
That's actually a complete satire. I think they tried to joke around, to play around, to mock our president, because to be honest, the president doesn't have a big role in Albania. He's just an honorific figure.
Right.
He doesn't have any powers. They have actually, the current government has cut also some extra powers to the president. So it's just a formal figure now, and that's what they have tried to say here, because the president doesn't actually have nothing to do with the economy, the free market model and stuff. So that's a spot on satire, actually.
Yeah, and the other part of this slideshow, which in some ways it's condescending, and I think it's in some ways not good satire, is that the title of this light show is The Land of the Free, 10 Ways You Know You're the Living in the Greatest Country on Earth, right? And what they're trying to say is Albania is not the greatest country on earth.
Yep.
And it's not the land of the free, and so we're going to make fun of you. But I think it's in some ways condescending, right? Because why couldn't it be the land of the free? Why couldn't it be the greatest country on earth, right? These are Americans making fun of Albania because it's a tiny country, and I don't think that's... I mean, it may be funny for Americans, but I'm sure that it's not funny for Albanians.
Oh, no. I assure you. I mean, it was fun for me. I understand the satire and everything, but for most Albanians, it wouldn't be, like, so fun.
Yeah, but it's still, the Onion has the right to associate with whomever it wants and publish that. And if you find it funny, well, it's funny. And if you don't, you can, I guess, sue them and fail, right?
Yep.
Okay, so now moving on to the specific question of freedom of association in Albania. Do you think, and we're going to come back to this at the end, do you think freedom of is the problem in Albania freedom of association, or is it rather that nothing has resulted in the recent past from freedom of association?
So communism in Albania, like in every other former communist country, actually fell because of people gathering with each other, demonstrating, rallying. That's how the communist regime fell.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really weird because in the early 1990s, like for the first time in decades, Albania started protesting again.
Mm.
45 years of the communist regime under Hoxha, people were not allowed to protest, not even think about protesting. Even those who dared to protest in the first year of communism, 1945, 1946, they were killed by the regime, especially people from the north, like who tried to resist to the Communist Party, they were killed. So, but yeah, eventually it started fading. We had this sense of rallying, this sense of demonstrating, protesting against the regime in the beginning. But once new parties were established, so we are a plurality now, wasn't only one party, people started to lose this sense of protesting and demonstrating and association with each other. And in the past 30 years, there are so few occasions that Albanians have gathered together to protest for a just cause. And when I say just cause, for an unjust law, for an unjust act, they have rallied and assembled and associated only when the political parties have called upon them to do so. So one party came into power, and the other party wanted to topple down the party in power, so they called their supporters to go and rally and demonstrate.
Yeah.
So I think there is a problem with association and assembly in Albania, but also that nothing has ever come out of it. Was like there was never a positive result out of it. Especially, I think, maybe just... In 2015, there was this deal struck between Albania and the EU in which we had to take these chemical weapons in Albania.
Mm.
And people, for the first time I remember, people actually assembled together without any party calling upon them. And they actually forced the government to refuse that deal.
Hmm.
So that was actually the only time. And maybe also the... protests about this theater, which we can talk a little later, but these are the only circumstances, like the only times that I remember that Albanians really assembled together for a just cause and not just for political interests.
But so what I guess you're saying, it's twofold. You're saying that framing the discussion in the way I try to frame it is not useful, and that the answer, if you want to play within my frame, is that it's both.
Yep.
Right? But what I mean by that is that it's not that the problem is freedom of association or that nothing results from it, is that it's wider than that. And two, if you had to answer the question, you would say that the problem is both. It's both that freedom of association is not, I guess, well regulated, and two, that even if it were well regulated, nothing results from it.
Yes, because again, we don't have that culture of protesting, of assembling, of fighting for causes, for just causes. Again, I want to emphasize this, because again, we go out and protest when our parties call us, our political party call us, but we don't go out there when there is something at stake, something that really matters. Again, here I can mention the National Theater, about which we wrote an article together. Few people went out on the streets that day that they demolished the theater. Basically, because most people didn't care, and that it's really a bad thing for democracy when people start not to care and just live with it. And because they feared, they were scared. So yeah, basically it's a twofold end. Like, if I would have to answer, I would say that it's both.
Yeah. Yeah, and now that we speak about that article on the theater that we wrote together, we titled it Albania No Longer Needs Old-Style Foreign Assistant, says former USAID administrator. And his point, when we showed him the article, because he, in the end, is my boss, right? The former USAID administrator is now this executive director of the McCain Institute. The full quote is, "The time is ripe for Albania to keep advancing towards an ever more democratic, prosperous, and secure nation," said Ambassador Mark Green, the executive director of the McCain Institute for International Leadership and former USAID administrator. And then he continued, "It no longer needs old-style foreign assistance, but rather the empowerment of Albanians to decide how and for whom the country should develop. Not only the cronies. The 27-month-long protest at the theater speaks to the opening of the democratic space, and it should be maintained." What do you think he meant by that?
I think he meant that Albanians shouldn't expect any more, like, assistance from the West. Like, we shouldn't look only to the Western powers when we are struggling with something. I think he was also calling upon Albanians, like, it is time that you take the wheel of the country, like, in your hands, and like go in the right direction, like towards the West. We will be there for you, like to host you in that circle of democracies, but you have to come there by yourself. Because that's the state of democracy. Like that's right. People have to have to learn that democracy is fostered only if you want it, like if you work for it.
Yeah, that reminds me of that famous line that we used in, I think, our first article together, that freedom is always one generation away from extinction. Amazing. I wanted to talk about what I've heard called dictatorship 2.0, or the dictator's learning curve. And my understanding is that currently under socialist president Edi Rama, Prime Minister, right?
Yep, he's the Prime Minister.
He is not neither a dictator nor an autocrat nor an authoritarian in the classical sense. He is what some people might call, and I don't know enough facts to know whether this is an accurate description, but some people might call him a competitive authoritarian, in the sense that there are somewhat free and fair elections in Albania. There's somewhat of freedom of association, somewhat of freedom of speech, but Prime Minister Rama sort of controls it to his own benefit, right? It's this idea that elected autocrats, they're elected in free and fair elections, and then they start amassing power and slowly eroding the foundations of democracy. Is that somewhat accurate, or is that helpful to think about Albania or not?
Yes. I mean, we talked about this together previously. We wrote about it, actually. Like, you know how it all started about Edi Rama was like, with this principled young guy in the early 90s, who actually was one of the most critical voices of the old regime, but also of his predecessor, Berisha. And he turned out to be, let's say, a bad copy of Berisha. Because he was the guy that criticized Berisha all the time about freedom of how Berisha was oppressing the freedom of speech, freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, and everything. And now he's doing the same. Like, there is this thing, you remember, we talked about it. Like, back in 1994, Berisha tried to pass this law that would muzzle every critical voice. And Rama was one of them. And today Rama is trying to do the same. We talked about it together, right? The Venice Commission said, look, the law that you brought us, like, it's terrible. You need to work on it because it violates freedom of expression from every corner. And now, in the past 2 days, there's news that the government actually, that he's trying to pass a law without even considering what the Venice Commission said. And that, like, I would say it's an indication of an autocrat, because he's not even listening to the internationals anymore.
Yeah, the Machiavelli, I think, had that famous phrase, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts, absolutely.
Yep.
The question is why, right? The question is why, and this is getting us a little bit off topic, but I think it's important. Why do people, I mean, the easy way to ask it is, why do people get corrupted, right? I think the more difficult way to ask it is, how does one build institutions so that when people like him or her get elected or rise to power, that the institutions survive, right? How do we create a polity, a country, institutions, a people, a culture, education? How do we build that so that we protect ourselves from tyranny in the end? How do we do it? What is it in education? Yep. Or I don't know. Do you have any answers?
Exactly. That's the point I was going to make. And I actually wrote about this, and I've discussed this with many people, even here in DC, with professors and people that were involved in the process, you know, being like vetting process in the justice system. One of the biggest mistakes I think that the internationals did is that they focused a lot on reforming the justice system, but without noticing how important it is, like also education of the other generations, because we are removing all these judges and prosecutors which are corrupt and unfit to serve. But still we are not reforming, let's say, the legal studies in Albania, like law school in Albania. We will have the same product,
right?
And not only law school, we need to change the entire education system. Because I think if we want to build a healthy society where people believe in democracy and the rule of law and good governance, and they understand that they are the sovereign and they should ask from the government and not the government from them, we need educated people. And you know that here in the US, maybe not to that extent, because I've asked a lot of people, it depends from state to state, but usually kids here are taught from a younger age about the principles of the Constitution, how they are the ones that uphold the Constitution, how they are the ones that should ask the government if they are not doing something right. In Albania, we don't have this. We are not taught, like, look, we have the power, we, the people of Albania, we have the power. We have a say in every decision that the government makes because we voted them and we expect them to serve us. So I guess the thing that we need to do is reform the education system, because we can't have good professionals, we can't have good politicians, we can't have good judges, we can't have good doctors that are not corrupted without believing, first of all, that a society can work only if we work on the rule of law and democracy.
Right, I think that's sometimes called the blindness of a profession or lawyers. Like when you're a lawyer, you see everything. When you're a hammer, everything you see is a nail, right?
Yeah.
And that's a mistake we make because we specialize and because we're trained, and then an economist only sees economic problems, a lawyer only sees legal problems, and so forth. And I think that's why we're enriched when we take a broader approach to education, when we consider all the aspects, right? Spirituality, religion, culture, music, education, law, economics, sociology, critical legal studies, anti-racism, like everything is important, right? Everything enriches us.
Yeah.
And if we shelter ourselves from the world and think one idea is better or worse, or that we shouldn't pay attention to a person because of whatever reason, I think we're doing a disservice to ourselves, because we refuse to give ourselves the full story, but also to everyone else, right? Because I think we must and we should be able to live together, assembling peacefully, or assembling peaceably, as the U.S. Constitution says, and also being able to control our destinies, right? And to your point about education in the United States, I remember as a young kid, when I lived in the United States, they used to show us this video. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's like a bill. It's like a cartoon of a bill, and he's like a character, and he's like dancing around the U.S. Capitol. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's super funny, and it's like it has this catchy song. I can't remember it right now, but any American probably would remember this and know what I'm talking about. But it tells you like what some people have said are the 6-7 steps to make a law in the United States. So it's this bill like walking through the members of the House or Senate, and then there's committee action, and then floor action, and then there's a vote, and then there's conference committees, and then there's presidential action, and finally the Office of Federal Register assigns the public law a number and then prints a copy of it, right? And then they're codified. But it's it's a really complicated process, right?
Yeah.
There's so many steps, there's so many people, there's so much lingo, there's markup and revise and committee, amendments, additional text, alter the bill, and then the president can veto it, but then you can do it with a supermajority. And there's like 10, anyways, I'm going on and on, but there's a way to create, I don't like to use the word because it's so part of the political science lingo, but a polity, right? A group of people that considers themselves part, and we were talking about this before, part of a nation state, I guess, because that's the best idea we've come up with since the Peace of Westphalia. But we create that assembly, that association within which we try to give everyone, and hopefully outside of it too, right? We can't be like, oh, we're Colombia and we don't want Venezuelans, which is a big issue in Colombia right now. Like, we want to give rights and freedoms to everyone who is in our territory in as much as we can, and give them health and food and everything that makes a life worthwhile, right? Culture and music. And it all comes through freedom of association. Sorry, long discourse, but any thoughts before I move on to LOPE, or what do we call it? LOPE?
Yeah, we can go ahead. Like, let's delve into the law.
Okay, how do you call it? How do you pronounce it? LOPE?
LOPG.
LOPG. That's how it's translated. Okay.
The Law on Public Gatherings.
Okay, so it's the Law on Public Gatherings number 8773. Dated April 23rd, 2001, which I understand is the law in force, correct?
Yep.
All right. So you mentioned before our taping that it was enacted 20 years ago. It was never amended to comply with international standards on freedom of assembly. And you noted three elements of concern. So, maybe let's just take them one by one. So what's the first element of concern?
So the first one, which I would consider, first of all, like, of course, like, the international standards have changed. Like, this law has been enacted 20 years ago, and you can imagine the immense practice that international organizations, the European Court of Human Rights, like Human Rights Committee, have come up with regard to the standards of freedom of assembly. It has evolved for sure. Like, the nature of human rights is to expand.
Right.
But the first concern is with regard to the prior notifications that the LOPG requires. So the LOPG requires prior notification from the organizers of the protest, actually. And then the police have to authorize the protest by informing the organizers within the time limits under Articles 5 and 7 of the law. And then, only then, the protest is considered to be legitimate. Only then can the people go to protest. But under international human rights law, domestic authorities are allowed to request advance notification of an assembly. And this has been confirmed, mm-hmm. actually, by the Human Rights Committee under the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and also by the European Court of Human Rights. And their logic has been that the aim of this is to prevent disorder and crime, but still countries should refrain themselves from using this as a chilling tool towards the freedom of assembly. So here it all depends on how democratic and liberal a state is.
And I wanted to see if you can walk me through what the actual text of the law is, because when I was reading it, I didn't understand it exactly in that way. So you mentioned Article 5, right, which says, in the case of a demonstration in squares of place or places of public passage, the organizer and director are obligated to notify the chief of the commissariat of police in writing no later than 3 days before the date of holding the demonstration, yes. Right? And then it says the elements of what it should include in writing. But then Article 7 says, well, when there are urgent circumstances, a demonstration may be conducted without respecting the time period, right? But you still have to do it, and it should be immediately, but no later than three hours before, right? But then Article 12, and this is what I don't understand, it says demonstrations in place, I mean, it's a typo, but I guess it says demonstration in places open to the public are also held without preliminary notification to the police according to Article 5 of this law. So what I understood from Article 12 is that really you don't have to notify the police, or do you? Or I'm not reading Article 12 well.
Well, yeah, it is correct, but it's still controversial. Like, that are open to the public. For example, we can take the protest for the theater. Even though it was a public area, like, where you could protest, people are still not allowed. And that also has to do with the fact that we are doing a pandemic, but we'll talk about it later, about that fact. Usually, even for spontaneous assemblies, like, under this law, you have to make a notification. And that is, it has to be 3 hours before you start. But under international standards, like, you lose the point of protesting when it's something spontaneous and something really urgent, because under international law, spontaneous assemblies are held like in a rapid response to an unforeseen development, and it shouldn't be subjected to prior notification procedures. That's what the ECTHR says, that what the Human Rights Committee says, that's what the Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Assembly and Association says. These two articles are controversial to each other.
Which ones?
Article 7, and Article 12.
Okay.
Because Article 7 talks about urgent demonstrations, which international law is referred to as spontaneous assemblies, and it says that you have to notify. Mm-hmm. But then in demonstrations in places open to the public, they can be held without preliminary notification under Article 5. But it doesn't talk about the preliminary notification under Article 7.
I see the difference.
The one
in
Article 7 is 3 hours prior to that. The one in Article 5 is 3 days, which doesn't make sense. Like.
But so if you were to write this law again, what would you add to make it clear? Because it's still not clear what Article 12, I guess what I'm understanding from what you just said is that Article 12 only relates to Article 5, but it doesn't relate to Article 7,
or
right?
Demonstration, but also to Article 5, it doesn't make any sense, because again, there was a protest on the 26th of June in Albania. They notified the police didn't get back to them. They went to protest, social distancing and everything in a public area, and then again, they were forcibly dispersed. So these articles 5, 7, and 12 are really like vague. You can't get much out of them. You can't understand how the police will react. You know that you have to make a notification. You know that the police have to authorize it, and only then you can go. But again, Article 12 doesn't go well with Article 7. But again, also with Article 5, it's not that clear. Because still, the police can disperse a crowd if they don't have a notification. So if the police doesn't like the fact, or they are given an order, look, they are protesting in a public park, go disperse them, because they don't have the authorization to assemble, the police can still do it. So I think...
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about Article 1, Section 2, because I think that's always the question, which is also seems... From what I remember, a verbatim copy of international standards, and it's always been a controversial limitation. It says this right, so freedom of assembly, is limited only if national security, public security, the protection of order and the prevention of crime, the safeguarding of health or morals, or the defense of the rights and liberties of others is endangered. I mean, you can put anything you're protesting for in any of those buckets, right? Yep. They would always have the right to limit a protest.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's why the at least the authorization procedure. Because, okay, international law allows notifications, like you have to notify the police if the state, if the government decides so. However, when it comes to authorizations, like, that's the point that I want, I would like to change. Because I like that what the special rapporteur, actually, on freedom of assembly and association, said back in 2015. He said that states should not impose authorization requirements as they turn the right into a privilege to be dismantled by the authorities and shift the burden to the organizers or participants to challenge a refusal rather than the authorities to justify the restriction.
Got it. So what you want to do is a burden shifting. You want to shift the burden from the protesters to justify their actions to the authorities to justify their actions.
That's what human rights are for. Like, human rights shouldn't be a privilege. I mean, you know that we have our rights just because we are humans from our nature.
We hold these truths to be self-evident. That all men and women and everyone else are created equal, that they're endowed by their creator or whomever else, or I don't know,
exactly,
with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, and freedom of assembly, right?
Yep.
Let's talk about point number two, and if you don't mind, since we prepared this, and listeners, you will know that we prepared arduously for this interview. We talked about the three elements, and the second one was that the law prohibits any clothing that conceals the identity of a protester.
Yeah.
So masks, etc., which is also a form of expression. So maybe talk a little bit about this, but also let's go right into the pandemic protests, because I think we've been foreshadowing that since the beginning, and people want to hear a little bit more about that.
With regard to this is prescribed by Article 19, prohibition of hiding the identity. So it says that the participation in demonstration with such clothing or the use of other things with the purpose of hiding the identity of the person is prohibited.
Right.
So if you look at international standards, they disagree with this, like all of them. Well, of course, this is for security reasons mainly. But the special rapporteur, for instance, has expressed his concern on laws that ban the use of face coverings, provided that there may be legitimate and non-criminal reasons for wearing a mask or face covering during a demonstration, including also a few of retribution. And he also provides that the laws which don't make any exceptions to this could be potentially used to discriminate, such in the case, for example, of woman wearing the niqab, let's say.
Right.
And this would prevent them from attending a protest. And it also could be used against individuals with medical disabilities who wear face masks, let's say, for medical purposes. For instance, I suffer from severe allergic reactions and shortness of breath from, let's say, from tear gas, pepper spray, or any other fume, usually. So I was caught up in this protest in Albania like 2 years ago. The opposition was demonstrating, and I was like 500 meters away from the protest. But still, it was very windy that night. And all the tear gas and the pepper spray that the police had used, it used a lot of it, came in my direction, and I got caught in that cloud of pepper spray and fume. And I had to go to the hospital. So imagine if I was in the protest.
Wow.
And I wouldn't be allowed to cover my face. So we have to consider that as well, I guess. And let's not forget that some masks can be used also for political statements. And you know that you're from Latin America, and you know that there was a trend in the last few years to use the hooded red costumes and the Dalí mask from La Casa de Papel as a political statement.
Yeah.
So that's why freedom of assembly and freedom of expression go by each other. Because wearing a mask, making a political statement, is a form of expression. So you would be denying the freedom of expression and also the freedom of assembly.
Right. There's a funny story in New York City with the pandemic. Sorry to push you in the pandemic.
We have to talk about it.
Right. Or maybe we don't want to talk about it. That's why we are so procrastinating, because it's all of our lived reality right now, and people are suffering so much, and it's difficult to talk about, especially, at least for me, from a place of like good fortune and good privilege and blessings, because I am, you know, I am removed from it a little bit. Anyways, Well, the funny story I wanted to mention is that in New York City, it's I don't know if it's true. It's just a joke, I think. But allegedly in New York City, it was there was a prohibition on using face masks in public to protest, I think. And then the state of emergency due to the pandemic was passed, and everyone was was obligated to wear face masks in public all the time. And so it was funny because at that one point in time, it was both illegal to wear a mask and it was mandatory to wear a mask.
That's funny. Yeah, at that situation, you wouldn't know what to do. But I think it's really important that the law shouldn't just prohibit it. It should, again, as I said earlier, it should be the burden should be on the government. Like to prove when a person can use it or not. Like, but if it's a political statement, if the protesters are peaceful, then why not allow it?
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree with you more on that. The question also coming back more to Albania is that last time I checked, around 50% of Albanians identify with the great religion of Islam, if I remember correctly.
The percentage goes up to 75%, but identify as practitioners and stuff.
Oh, okay. But in that religion, one is in some cases mandated to cover one's skin in some ways, right?
And so
it's as we've seen in France, the banning of the burqa is probably counterproductive, right?
Yeah, I mean, but in Albania it's not like there's not so many Muslim women that cover themselves. And even if they do, it's not that culture of using a niqab or a burqa. It's more of a Turkish style in which you cover just your hair and your neck and your face is completely visible.
Right, but we've seen what happened with the scarf, as some people call it, which is not a scarf, right? It's a different thing.
Yeah.
In Turkey, precisely, right? It's that famous case from the European Court of Human Rights.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyways, let's move on to the third, which is, well, why don't you talk about your third element of concern about LOPG, the Law on Public Gatherings 8773 of Albania, if you're just joining us on this episode.
So the third element, and then we dive more into the pandemics, like protests and pandemic. Let's just keep it
finally
really fast. So under Article 9 and 16 of the LOPG, a protest can be dispersed or stopped by the police if a crime is committed. The organizer of the protest allows armed people to participate in the protest, or when the police has a motivated reason to believe that the protest will turn violent. What I don't like here is that it says that when the organizer of the protest allows armed people to participate in the protest. So how can one person, one guy, know if a protester has a gun or not, is armed or not?
Right.
So I don't like that at all. That should be removed immediately. Like, you know, how's the practice of, like, international standards and the European Court of Human Rights? In case that a group of people or a person are violent, the police has to remove that person in order to allow the others to enjoy the right to freedom of assembly. Like, speaking in short term, like, because we want to move forward.
Right. Okay, let's talk about the pandemic. Go.
Yep. So, during the pandemic, you know that in every country, countries, like, in all over the world, countries have started to restrict certain rights, including the freedom of assembly and association, in order to social distance, to stop the spread of the virus, etc. But we have seen also other countries that still are allowing people to protest, including the US, the UK, France, Germany, all these Western countries. We have seen demonstrations during the past few months. But in Albania, it is still prohibited to protest. So there were three major protests in the past 6 months. It was the protest for the theater, which we talked about. It was another protest on June 26th with regard to the protection of the rivers in Albania, which was forcibly dispersed. And also we had another one like last week of a group of people who weren't paid by the company, by a private company for 22 months. The government did nothing. So, and they tried to negotiate with the owner of the company, everything. nothing worked out, so they decided to protest and break the curfew and go. And they were beaten, there were some were imprisoned, they were released later, but still, the right to freedom of assembly was chilled in that case. The thing is that the government has been using the pandemic as the main reason for not allowing gatherings of people. But what I don't like is the fact that all summer long, people have been going to weddings, closed spaces with 300, 400, 500 people inside, going to parties all summer long, and other like similar gatherings, which doesn't make sense. And the government has done nothing to stop these. So why not allow people to protest in open spaces for causes that matter, such as the demolition of the theater, or because of the fact that the government is giving all the rivers around Albania as a concession to private companies, or the fact that people are not getting paid and they can do nothing else except protesting. Why stop this? Like, for instance, like the protest for the protection of the rivers on June 26th, there were only like 60 or 70 protesters. They were all social distancing. They had masks. And they were still, they were forcibly dispersed, which doesn't make any sense. And I'm sure even tonight is late in Albania, but if you could go earlier in the bars of Tirana, I'm sure you could find people packed in those bars.
Right. Yeah, I agree with the rhetorical question, which is not so rhetorical. Like, why this hypocrisy? Why this? And the easy answer, but maybe the not complete answer is because the government does this because it can, but also because going to bars or to weddings or parties or similar gatherings doesn't affect the government's power. But the moment, right, it's that Frederick Douglass quote that power concedes nothing without a demand, never has and it never will. So the question is, the same old question, which it sounds so repetitive that we bring it up again, but how do we build institutions so that when 100 years of pandemics like this one and the ones that will come in the future or anything else, how do we build institutions that we've answered this a little bit, like education,
that's the main
and things like that, but what in this specific situation, right, that this pandemic, sadly it seems and tragically, might go on for maybe another 2 years or something, and governments are just learning about it and how to utilize it for their own, in some cases, nefarious ends. So what can a response be? And maybe this, we can move on to a solution, a way forward. Like what we wrote about in our script was ideas, counterarguments, a discussion. Like, how do you see this both analytically? Like, how do you analyze this as an Albanian living in the United States at the moment? But how do you find both the descriptive methods to describe the problem and the normative solutions? Sorry to be so technical and lawyerly, but how do you think about this? What is the way forward?
That's a $1 million question.
Well, or like $100 million
or more.
Yeah.
It's really tough. Like, when you think what the pandemic is doing around the world, I fear that it's hurting more those countries that are unstable. And I guess we agree on this. Countries which have a consolidated democracy. People know that their government will work for them, that their government will do the best to represent their interests in the best way. And then there are countries like Albania or other, everywhere around the world, Africa, Latin America, Asia, that don't have these rules, like strong roots of democracy and the rule of law and good governance. And Albania is one of them, and that's what I fear the most, because our government is claiming that they are doing all of this for our sake, for the sake of the people, to protect the people. But as I said earlier, they're not protecting the people. Like, the number of cases is going up because people are staying all together in closed areas, etc. And on the other side, they are restricting rights, including the right to freedom of assembly. And I fear that it will have a really negative result, because even now, people are accepting the fact that they cannot protest. And this is very concerning for fostering a better society, a democratic one. Like the people are accepting the fact that they are being oppressed. They know that the government, what the government is doing is wrong, but they are not doing anything about it. So this will be the worst outcome out of this pandemic for a society like Albania. With regard to the way how to move forward, that is really difficult. Again, as I said, we need better education in society. We need to teach ourselves about all these rights that we have. The fact that we are the ones that control our own fates. Some say that the regime should change. We have tried that. Edi Rama, as I said, he promised that he will be different from our last prime minister. He turned out to be worse. And also the other guy that's on the opposition, he claims that he's good, but you never know. But are we going to just keep make this rotation every 8 years? For the past 30 years, it hasn't worked. And I know that it's not enough. Because, you know, countries like France and the UK, it took them like five centuries. Come to the point where they are at. But in terms of like how to move forward, I think it's just, again, I think the best solution is to work with the people, to work with the civil society in Albania. It is my strong belief that the only change in Albania can come only from the civil society. We don't have civic space in Albania. We don't have this sense of community. We don't have this sense of fighting for the just causes. So I think the more we teach Albanians in general about their rights, how they can impact decision-making and everything, that is the only way to move forward, I think. I think we can't change much from the top. We don't have good politicians right now, unfortunately. But nothing can come from the political class at this point.
Yeah, and I would even argue that nothing can ever come from the political class, right? Yep. That one must always build from the bottom up, because one must always remember that the political process is door to door, right? You have to, whatever your views are, you have to go door to door convincing people of your views and do it peacefully and do it democratically, and then get a good amount of people to change the system in whichever way you want, and accept that there are other people who have the same idea and who will knock on as many doors as you, and that in some ways democracy, at least as some people understand it, is a way to resolve differences peaceably, to use the words of the Constitution. And about I don't know how you call that paradigm, I guess, that in some ways you didn't say this, but some people refer to it as, oh, that country is not ready for democracy, right? It's that age-old trope. I remember one time I was in this conference, and I was talking to some Chinese colleagues, and we kept talking about how they felt that China was not ready for democracy. No, and the usual answers we're giving, it's too big, it's too wide, it's too ancient, it's a different culture. Like, yeah, all those things are true. But I don't think that, one, there is any person on this land and beyond and in the universe that doesn't want to control their own destiny, right? And as Churchill used to like to say, what is it? Democracy is the worst of all systems except for all the rest. So I think you're spot on, right? We must do the hard work of building civil society that takes centuries, if not millennia, but not forget that that cannot be an argument for us to be complacent. And I remember, if I may, because we're already at 75 minutes, tell you a story about this and read you a poem. Hopefully you like, and it's a very short poem, and you can always cut the poem out or the story or whatever you want of mine. But the story is the following. Secretary Albright, which was maybe the first woman Secretary of State of the United States.
Yeah, it was the first one.
Yeah, she was the first one. Okay. I'm just confused because I was thinking about may she rest in peace, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, which was the second U.S. justice. Anyway, a big tangent, but the first woman justice in Colombia was assassinated, so that's a tragic story. So Secretary Albright was speaking to Ambassador Green, and she addressed this argument head on. She said how a lot of people, both when she was Ambassador to the United Nations and the Secretary of State, had that argument. Oh no, our country is not, it's too young for democracy. We're not ready. And she always responded, if I remember correctly, and we would have to go back and watch the YouTube recording because it's recorded, something along the lines of, every person deserves to be, and this is where I read my poem, master of their fates and captains of their soul, right? And I wanted to read that poem in full. It's only four stanzas, but it is allegedly the poem that Nelson Mandela memorized and recited to himself every day for his 27 years of captivity. I think that's the legend. I don't know if it's true, but the poem is the following. It's called Invictus, by William Ernest Henley. Out of the night that covers me, black as the pit from pole to pole, I thank whatever gods may be for my unconquerable soul. In the fell clutch of circumstance, I have not winced nor cried aloud. Under the bludgeonings of chance, my head is bloody but unbowed. Beyond this place of wrath and tears looms but the horror of the shade, and yet the menace of the years finds and shall find me unafraid. It matters not how straight the gate, how charged with punishments the scroll. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. So that's just to say that I am the master of my fate, but only as long as I associate with people of many kinds, right? I don't think one should limit oneself to associating only with the people one likes or with one's friends on Facebook or on Twitter or on Instagram or on WeChat or on TikTok, right? It's about creating a common ground where everyone can freely associate within bounds, right? Of course, there's a limit. And my limit is whenever anyone starts inciting violence, right? That's where I refuse to associate myself with anyone of any political persuasion that even comes close to that line, right? I think that should be a clear line, like apologias or being an apologist for violence should be the line where you stop, even if people like never say it out loud, but you know when someone is like making like veiled threats, and I think that's a point where you should call them out and say, no, this is not correct, this is not right, please leave my assembly, please leave my protest. And if they persist, I think one should be able to call the monopoly of violence, which is allegedly the nation state, and in some ways and in some cases and hopefully with the most liberal democratic ways to try to stop violence, because I don't think the world can resist more violence. Anyways, long soliloquy, but those are where my thoughts are. I don't know if you have anything to add, but if not, and if you do, say it.
No, I think it was perfect. There's no point.
Okay. I don't think it's perfect. Nothing is perfect, but you can always improve. But on that note, today your host was tough to my interview. I'm really thankful, Albie, for inviting me, for all the work that you do. Our conversations are always very enlightening. I learn about so many things, both when you propose things like this to me, when we write together. But this has been particularly fruitful, and I've enjoyed it a lot because I've learned much more about you and where you come from, and I really like the way you think and talk, and I do wish you the best, and thank you again for coming on your own podcast and allowing yourself to be interviewed. So with that, thank you so much, Albie, and I'm really happy to know you. So I hope, I can't wait to see where this goes.
Of course. I mean, I'm looking forward to work more together. And thank you for hosting me again. And why not, in another episode, I will host you again.
Yeah, that would be, I'd gladly come back to your podcast or anything. And I hope you come back to your own podcast soon too, as the host.
Yeah, of course. And I mean, eventually, why not? Like, because this is going good. It could be like Rule of Albania with Albi Cella and Pedro Pitano. You never know. So.
Hey, don't promise what you can't keep. I think what we should do is Rule of Law Colombia. I'm going to do a franchise.
Yeah, sure.
For sure, man. Well, I really appreciate it. Have a good evening, and congrats again.
You too.
All right, take care.